Mark Peterson, and this is the Stronger Philanthropy Podcast. This is episode 5. This is where we love giving well. I first met today's guest back in 1987 when I was a graduate student at Tyndale Seminary in Toronto. He was my professor of counseling. Rod Wilson moved on from there to eventually become president of Regent College in Vancouver. Regent, on the beautiful campus of the University of British Columbia, became a magnet for high-caliber graduate-level theological education, focused on preparing lay people for professional careers with an integrated spirituality. While at Regent, one of Rod's main tasks was to lead the fundraising initiatives such as the development of a new underground library. He successfully raised a lot of money, but he did it in a way that was transparent, humane, and authentic. Today, while he's retired from the presidency, he has just completed a book, not just released, on philanthropy. He's thought a lot about this idea of philanthropy and has much to contribute to our discussion. Let's hear him now. Rod Wilson, it's great to have you here. I remember the first time that we met was at Tyndale Seminary in 1987. And you were a young professor at the time, and I was a graduate student. Do you remember those days?
I do remember those days, particularly the young professor part.
Oh, that we were back in those days.
Yes. No, it's great to be with you, Mark. I appreciate the chance to talk about this important subject.
Thank you so much. I've watched your path along the way as you move from Tyndale Seminary, and then you eventually moved over to Regent College in Vancouver, and you served there with distinction for a number of years, about 12 years, was it?
15, actually.
15 years, yes. Yeah. And I think you started at Regent College back when I started at Bridgeway Foundation, and our paths kind of intersected at that point, and over the 2000s, at least, you and I connected several times.
Yes, we did. No, that's right.
And then last year, you had a moment when we thought we might have almost lost you, and that was a big scare. And we're glad to still have you with us.
Thank you. Yes, I was in the middle of a lecture at Regent College and experienced a small stroke. So that was quite a shock for me, as well as for the students who were listening to me. So, yeah, I'm thankful that we're past that now and looking in the rearview mirror.
And you're better now?
Yes, I am. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, much great. Better. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. I remember one particular grant that we were involved in back in the middle of the 2000s with Regent College, which related to a capital campaign that Regent ran, and we were involved in it. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that campaign experience and what you learned in the process of that?
Yeah, it was really my first, maybe back up just a little bit. I mean, I've lived a life of, I describe as vocational confusion, where I finished my university training originally with a doctorate in clinical psychology and then did a master's in theology. And then I've been in and out of the academic world and the nonprofit world and the pastoral world. And then in 2000, as you said, ended up at Regent College. And as part of my job as president, obviously fundraising was a key component of it. And I'd done some fundraising informally and in pastoral ministry up to that point. But early in 2000s, we were really struggling with the capacity of our library, both books and study spaces, and really needed to upgrade our information technology and do some renovations in the facility. So we put a $15 million campaign on the table. And I found the experience incredibly instructive and educative about the whole nature of both asking for money and receiving money. And the whole tension, I think, as a Christian, like to what degree does one trust and rely on the providence and provision of God, and to what degree does one rely on human diligence and effort and energy? And I think that's been probably God's syllabus for me most of my life, has been around this topic of, you know, where does my work stop and start, and where does God's work stop and start, and how do I co-create and partner with God and what I'm seeking to do. And I found that the tangible aspect of money and the raising of money really brought that to the surface for me in really powerful ways of, you know, sometimes finding myself preparing excessively and with great diligence and conscientiousness and finding nothing happened. And then other times going into meetings, maybe somewhat unprepared and not very hopeful and coming out with a rather large gift and trying to make the linear connection between my diligence and conscientiousness and God's provision. And I never could figure out that equation perfectly well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was, I don't know, living into the mystery of the fundraising enterprise was probably one of the biggest lessons I learned in that process.
So it sounds like you're saying there's no clear-cut pathway to banking that check that you're hoping for.
No. Yeah, I think...
Is that reductionistic?
Yeah, I think it is.
Fundraising like that.
Yeah, there's a... I mean, I think a lot of what I pick up, you know, in conferences or reading or books is it has a... Well, it's like a lot of the culture right now. There's kind of a mechanistic, prescriptive way to do things. You know, if you want to improve your marriage or your parenting or build a new house or raise funds, that there's, you know, there's some magical formula that if you follow, it almost guarantees success. And I really wonder whether we're being sold something on this mechanistic technology orientation that really leads us to frustration and confusion. And I think in fundraising, that's very much the case. I found this area much more ambiguous and chaotic and mystical, and found the way that God worked through people was not always predictable. So there was a lot of surprise by joy for me, to quote a book title. Mm-hmm. I think that was a lot of what I experienced, and it created more wonder rather than clarity, I think.
Can you think of one incident that brought you the most joy during your time there?
Well, I think...
Maybe not the most, but something that brought you joy.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the meetings that I went into, it was a luncheon meeting with a family, and I went into the meeting not really going to ask for money, not really having the library as a focus. We didn't even know where we were building the library at that point. And so I went into the meeting with, I wasn't pessimistic, but I wasn't particularly hopeful, and I wasn't even asking for money. And as the meeting went along, I realized that this family was very, very interested in libraries and books and the preservation of books and study space for students and these things that were very close to the heart of what the vision was at the school. And the meeting, what I thought was going to be an hour and a half lunch, turned into a four-hour lunch. And at the end of the meeting, I said, "You're really interested in libraries, aren't you?" And they said, "Yeah, we are." And I said, "Like, could I talk to you about contributing to the library?" And they said yes. And by the time that process ended, a number of months later, it turned into a $3.3 million gift. Hmm. And it wasn't so much the amount for me, although the amount was incredibly significant and made me, you know, very pleased at all sorts of levels. But I think what struck me in that interaction was how the human diligence and God's work are not always paired together. Like my expectation wasn't high. I wasn't filled with hope. I hadn't prayed for hours ahead of time. And yet something amazing came out of that. And I think the other piece of it that was really important for me was the relationship that developed. I mean, that initial meeting was one of my first interactions with that family. And since that, there's just been a really, really close personal relationship. And, you know, I would say we're confidants in many ways with each other. And I just found that really powerful. And I think if you told me 10 years before that the raising of money would lead to joy and relationship and mutual sharing of confidences, I think I would have been shocked. I wasn't expecting that at all. But it was a wonderful outcome of that experience.
Mm. What do you think it is about philanthropy that can make the connection so deep and intimate between a fundraiser and a donor?
Yeah.
Because there is something in a very small percentage of the times, it does seem to move into something very meaningful.
Yeah. Well, I think you know, historically, the emphasis that a number of people have noted over the years, that money, sex, and power are three aspects of who we are that are pretty close to our essence, to our identity, to our being. And I think when you talk to anyone about their money, their sexual issues, their issues around power, you're getting pretty close to the core of who they are. And I think vice versa, they're getting pretty close to the core of who we are as well. So I think money is one of those areas that we have a relationship with. I don't think money's a distant, you know, material thing. I actually think we're in relationship with money. So anytime, you know, as fundraisers, we're in relationship with money, going to philanthropists, we're in relationship with money, you're getting close to the heart of who people are. And I think inevitably, there's a lot of self-disclosure. I mean, the very giving of a gift, whatever the size may be, is a disclosure of who you are. And I think it gets to the core of who people are. And I find Jesus' reminder in Matthew 6 that, you know, there's the money has the capacity to be worshipped in the same way that God has the capacity to be worshipped. So I think we're even getting close to people's spiritual identity in essence, whatever their religious persuasion may be. I think we're getting very close to that too. So it feels like if you talk to me about my money, you're really getting close to who I am. And then if we continue that conversation, you're going to get closer to who I am, and we're probably going to be in relationship of some sort.
Very good. Yeah, I in doing my research on having our chat today, I discovered the cover story in Faith Today that you wrote recently.
Mm-hmm.
And you had that quote by Sigmund Freud: money questions will be treated by cultured people in the same manner as sexual matters, with the same inconsistency, prudishness, and hypocrisy.
Yeah.
And you've dealt with that just now in your response.
Yeah, I think I think that's such an important area, because if you take that sort of traditional distinction between being, doing, and having, I think when we think of philanthropy and fundraising, so much of the emphasis is on what we do with what we have. And, you know, the consumption side of life is the emphasis. So, if, you know, if somebody has a capacity to give, they have money, and then we want to do something to get their money as fundraisers. But I think in essence, where we're at, I think as those creating the image of God, our being is foundational to all of that. So I think when fundraising gets into this, you know, what do you have and what can I do to get what you have, we're missing something really important.
Hmm. I was at an event recently that you spoke at, and you talked a bit during that event about the idea of wealth creation. And you were speaking to a room full of philanthropists. You were speaking about wealth creation in the sense that in our culture and in our faith communities both, we have a distorted or a twisted understanding of wealth creation. Would you like to just delve into that a little bit more? What kind of understanding on wealth creation would be healthier for us to have, or more integrated?
Yeah, I think if we... I mean, I say this from a Christian perspective, but I think this applies to a secular perspective as well. I don't think it's confined to a religious sensibility. But I think the giving of money presupposes that the money has been made. I mean, by definition, if you're going to give money, you must have it. And then you've accumulated it in a particular way. And so I find in the philanthropic realm right now, there's a lot of talk about our sort of social responsibility, our social justice responsibility, our ethical responsibility to give, to address the needs of what's going on in the world. And that's very appropriate. I think when we analyze what's going on in the world and the culture, that's a very important perspective we need to have. And then we look at what we have and what we can give to the world. But I don't think ethics end there. I think ethics also go to how did we actually get the money? And if we amassed our wealth, or our wealth was created with a lack of ethics, a lack of integrity, a lack of care for creation, I think there's a deep sense in which our giving is actually not reflective in how we got the money that we're giving. And so I think an ethical perspective, or for me, a Christian perspective on giving, would mean that not just the giving of our money, but how we created that money also needs to be given an ethical grid. I love the in the Message, there's a lovely proverb in Proverbs 10 and 2 where it says, ill-gotten gain gets you nowhere. An honest life is immortal. And so, you know, if you don't, and this is a great emphasis in the wisdom literature, like, how did you become who you are? It's not so much have you risen to the top, or have you become wealthy, or are you a generous person, but how did you get there? How did you make your money? And I fear, frankly, I'm not thinking of names when I say this, I'm just thinking of a trend, but I think the emphasis in the culture right now of giving a lot of money, and particularly very wealthy people giving a lot of money to address the needs of the world and some of the global problems that are present now, one of the questions that need to be asked is some of that giving an atonement for doing something inappropriate in the amassing of the wealth? Mm-hmm. And then I think the other component of this as well is the impact on creation. I mean, I think a lot of there's lots of businesses that amass immense fortunes, but in the process, they're destroying creation and destroying the environment and facilitating global warming and many things that are going on in the world and in the planet. So ironically, one might give for the good of the planet, but have amassed their wealth in a way that actually reflected a lack of care for the good of the planet.
Very true.
Having wealth implies having inherent power. I'm hoping that you can speak to the issue of power and the challenges and opportunities of power for philanthropists.
Yeah, I was driving downtown in Vancouver just yesterday and drove by a sign just in the inner city, and the sign said, "Wealth is a crime." Which I found to be an interesting social commentary on how some people perceive wealth. I would not want to say wealth is a crime. What I would want to say is wealth does bring incredible power. I think on a superficial side, you know, when you have a lot of wealth and you have high financial capacity, it gives you power to purchase. I think the consumerist culture is well addressed by the power of wealth, that the more we have, the more we can buy. And so we have more power that way. And then the derivative power that comes from driving a certain kind of car, living in a certain kind of house, or taking a certain kind of holiday, it means you've got power that way. But I think power also is an insidious psychological thing that I think some of us, out of deep inadequacy and deep insecurity in amassing wealth and amassing things, we feel more powerful. So you'll even see that in the news or on the internet or in newspapers, where people are described as the most powerful people in the world. And often these are people with profound wealth and multi-billion dollars of assets. And so they're seen to be powerful. And I think power in that sense is almost compensatory, that, you know, the deeper inadequacy you have, it's addressed by the more money you have. But then the more virtuous approach to power, it seems to me, is power to influence and power to change. And I think when you do have wealth of whatever sort, and I think wealth is a very subjective term, but when you've got money of any sort, you have power to influence and power to change. And when that's done in a virtuous way, and when it's really met with a, you know, a particular need or lack or inadequacy in the culture or with people or with a certain part of the world, the power to change and the power to influence is massive. So I think there's a, you know, we often use the word stewards, both in religious and secular culture, to talk about people with money need to steward their money well. But I think stewarding your money means that you give up the power in giving the money away. You don't use the power either for your, you know, to make yourself look good or significant, but you actually use the power to influence for good.
So stewarding has a deeper connotation than we're used to, I guess.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Because you're, you know, when I hear people, and you hear this often now in popular culture, like so-and-so is giving away 80% of their wealth, in a way that doesn't tell you anything, because I think if you're living a non-fragmented life, the corollary question is, what are you doing with the 20%? you know, and 20% of some people's net worth is a massive amount of money. So maybe giving away 80% isn't a lot of money by some standard. And the widow's mite, you know, she gave all that she had, is a pretty powerful standard for what it means to be a good steward, I think.
Mm-hmm.
How would you counsel new philanthropists that are perhaps just learning about philanthropy? They have a heart to be generous. They desire to respect their faith and honor God through their giving. But they have somehow acquired a significant wealth and want to be generous. How would you counsel these people?
You know, my first humorous answer would be to read my new book.
Oh, you have a new book?
Yes.
Tell us about
it. Keeping Faith in Fundraising, that's being published by...
That was my next question. Okay. That was my last question.
So, I mean, that's my humorous answer. Read the book, Keeping Faith in Fundraising, coming out by Erdmann's later this year. But my more serious answer would be, and this sounds terribly pious, and I'm not known for that, but I'm going to say it anyway, is read 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. I think that's where I would start. And read how the Apostle Paul unpacks this area of philanthropy in ways that are shocking. I mean, I've read those two chapters many times, but when I got into fundraising and actually read them again, I thought he's got so much to offer on the world of philanthropy and the way he talks about philanthropy. So I think any new person who wants to, you know, express their Christian faith by being generous, I would start there with 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. And then I would caution them to not be need-oriented. I think the need-oriented culture has just sent too many philanthropists down the wrong road. I think...
Okay. What do you mean by that exactly?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, when Abraham Maslow created this hierarchy of needs as sort of a psychological thing back in the 60s, I think a lot of us in the popular culture now consider need to be the primary way to frame many things, including philanthropy. So the purpose of having money is to give to those who have a need or expressing a need. Well, the problem is that need used to be a verb. So I need water, I need shelter, I need food, I need sleep. But now need has become a noun. And underneath that is this massive list of things. So almost every charity is going around talking to people with money, expressing the need they have. I have a need for this. I have a need for this. I have a need for that. And I think with technology and social media, needs now are dominating the landscape. And I think many people who want to be generous are overwhelmed with all the needs. And they're looking at a horizontal level at all the needs. And they're confused to know even what to do. And I've talked to many, many philanthropists over the years who say they're almost paralyzed now because there are so many needs. And everybody seems to have a need that's legitimate and viable and deserving of their money. So I think, you know, the language or the suggestion I would make to new philanthropists is to try to root your whole approach to this in a more vertical perspective first, understanding that God is not a God of scarcity, that he's a God of abundance, that understanding God is a generous God, not a stingy God, rooting yourself in the who God is, who am I paradigm, back to the being thing we talked about earlier. And then having more a sense of direction and call and passion vision rather than need meeting. Mm-hmm. Because I think need meeting is impossible to get to the end of. It's a bit like, you know, in marriage, I hear sometimes from people saying, you know, my spouse isn't meeting my needs, so I'm going to leave him or I'm going to leave her. Well, you know, my wife doesn't meet my needs either, and I don't meet hers. Like, I got too many needs to be met by one person.
By one person.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And so I think the concept needs to be really questioned significantly. And I think once people who have projects frame it in need language and then talk to philanthropists who are trying to meet needs, I think we start down the wrong road. I think this is
absolutely
shared vision, shared passion, relationship, a real sense of connectedness between people that both of them have a sense of, if you like, use the word call, have a sense of call that this is what God wants both of them to do. And after good conversation and dialogue, they realize they're basically about the same thing. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that's just a better trajectory for philanthropy, because if you're into meeting needs, I think you just get paralyzed and overwhelmed.
Thank you. That's really great advice. And it takes us back to being self-aware.
Yeah.
You know, knowing who we are, which takes me back to my first counseling class I ever took with you. You know, and you've been preaching that for 30 years now.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's great. Rod, can you just give us again the name of your new book coming out and how we can get a copy of it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's at the publisher right now as we speak. It'll be coming out later in 2016 by Erdmans, and it's called Keeping Faith in Fundraising. And I've written, co-authored this with Peter Harris, who's the co-founder of Arasha, the Christian Conservation Organization. And he and I both ended up, when we went into our careers of various sorts, fundraising was not on the job description for us, but we both ended up doing fundraising, and we've learned so much from doing it. So our book basically is divided into three parts. We're looking at the 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 in detail, and then the second part of the book looks at some themes that have come out of that. And then the third part of the book is biographical. We basically tell stories of our fundraising and where we've, you know, learned and where we haven't learned and where we feel like we are so-called successful and where we feel like we were so-called failure, just to kind of give people a sense that there's a narrative behind this world of fundraising, and often it's about stories.
Okay, that's great. I'll be sure to put the link to that in my show notes for this episode. Can you pre-order the book already or not yet?
I don't think yet. No, it's still, they're still okay. Early in the process. Yeah.
Well, let me know when it's available, and I'll make sure those of us in this network can access it in some way.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks, Rod, for joining us today and giving us some chewy nuggets to mull over. I hope you enjoyed this interview. Let me know your thoughts and feedback in response. I want to make sure that I mention that at the bottom of every blog post which features these podcasts, I have show notes, which are links to things that are referenced during the podcast. So in today's show notes, you'll find links to Regent College and also the Faith Today article. Next episode, we have Alan and Donna Lamshed with us. They created the Acts of Grace Foundation and will speak to us about what they've learned in the years since they've been operating, first in the shadows, and then more recently launching a website, hiring an employee, and having a more visible presence. That concludes today's podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our website at strongerphilanthropy.ca, or you can find us on iTunes and in your Android podcatcher apps. If you want to reach out, please feel free to connect by email at strongerphilanthropy@gmail.com. Message me on Twitter at LoveGivingWell or Facebook, Stronger Philanthropy. Buen camino.